From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In Syria, the year is ending the same way every year has since 2011, with a civil war still raging. Government forces are on the offensive in Idlib province in the northwest, fighting to overrun what's described as the last rebel stronghold in Syria, in this case, al-Qaeda fighters. Hundreds of thousands have died in this conflict that started as a peaceful protest but has since turned into a complicated proxy war. It's also triggered a refugee crisis with millions of civilians fleeing. People are trying to get away from this latest fighting. The BBC's Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher is in London. And Sebastian, many Americans might be forgiven if the last they heard was that President Trump pulled U.S. troops out of parts of northeast Syria back in the fall, which cleared the way for Turkey to attack the U.S. allies, the Kurdish fighters. Turkey sees them as terrorists. But fill in the gaps. Where are we today in Syria?
Well, I guess we're in a stage where President Assad is master of much of a country in a way that 2 or 3 years ago would have seemed unlikely. Thanks to the Russians in particular, the Iranians too.
The Russians in particular backing Syria with air power.
They are. I mean, without that air power, President Assad, I mean, before the Russians came in back in late 2015, he was very much on the back foot. And Idlib had been taken at that point by the rebels when you could really call them rebels, when it looked like, you know, they had a chance of actually overthrowing President Assad and his regime. Since then, each month, each year has seen President Assad with Russian help, with the help of Iran as well, very much, and militias that they have sent, that they've backed. He's been able to push back the rebels. So there was a deal done a few months ago after the fighting had really reached a level where there was a great concern that a new humanitarian disaster was about to erupt. Russia brokered it. But since then, that was back in August, it's been broken time and time again, this ceasefire. What we've seen in the past week has been a serious new offensive launched by the Syrian government, again backed by Russian air power, moving further up from the south of Idlib. And the goal, I mean, one is, of course, to try and take Idlib back, but more so to take full control of the sort of commercial artery that runs through Syria, which is the M5 highway, which runs from the Jordanian border up into Turkey. It runs through Damascus, it runs through Hama, it runs through Homs, and it runs up to Aleppo. Mm-hmm. Now, where the fighting is taking place at the moment is, again, just bordering that motorway. So there is a strategic interest for the Syrian government in this latest upsurge.
What happens now, because we also know Turkey, as we said, crossed the border and was attacking the Kurds, who they see as terrorists. But Turkey also backs Syrian rebels. And, you know, and here
it
you
does.
Have. Yeah. So how what happens now?
It does. But in a sense, it backs slightly different rebels from these rebels. I mean, it is a complicated situation.
Yeah.
And that isn't to kind of dismiss it and to say, you know, that we shouldn't think about it. But it has reached a stage, as I say, even to talk about rebels in some ways doesn't really make sense anymore. And these are militias, these are forces which are fighting for various reasons. The main militia was once al-Qaeda's franchise in Syria. They sort of broke apart from al-Qaeda some time ago, but they've kept the jihadist ideology. Now, the rebels that were fighting on the Turkish side over to the northeast were actually a different group of rebels. They were the ones that were once backed by the Americans, by the West, the Free Syrian Army. They have essentially lost their cause a long time ago and have fractured and now, you know, basically fight again for their own local reasons, but also for whoever is paying. So, you know, that's where the difficulty, perhaps understanding quite what's happening there, comes from. But I mean, I think each winter it really seems that we're talking again about a possible humanitarian catastrophe in Syria. Time and again, there's been one city or one region which has come under attack. Winter is very harsh there. And we're seeing tens of thousands of people, many of them children again, who are having to flee. Many of them are fleeing for the second or third time during the conflict. As I said, many have come from other parts of Syria. They may be moved to another part before reaching Idlib. Idlib was essentially their last stop on that trail. The next stop is Turkey. Many of them are going towards the border, but Turkey is not allowing them in now. Turkey has around 3.7 million Syrian refugees. And part of that incursion you were talking about over to the northeast from a Turkish perspective was to repatriate, was to send back at least in the first instance a million Syrian refugees there. So the Turks have been saying, we're not going to allow these refugees in. This is a problem the whole world needs to face up to and do something with. We can't just be, again, the country that has to deal with this overflow. So, you know, huge complications again. But I mean, I think from, you know, the public perception, what will grab attention again will be this idea of children out in fields, away from their homes, having to fend for themselves without aid being able to get through, even if they've escaped the bombardment. And you know, a number of them haven't. Just today, we heard that at least five children were killed when a school was bombed.
BBC Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher in London, speaking of the terrible conflict in Syria. Sebastian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report that in 2017, gun-related deaths in the U.S. reached the highest levels in decades. That was true in the city of Columbus, Ohio, where 119 people were killed by guns that year. Since then, the city has tried to lower the homicide rate. It formed a task force that takes a public health approach to every gun-related death in hard-hit neighborhoods. As Paige Flager reports from member station WOSU, officials believe it's helping.
It was April 1st at exactly noon when Crystal Logan got the phone call. Her daughter Janaea and her son Donnell had been shot.
As often as we see it on the news, you really never think that it would happen to you. You know, just, I mean, literally 20 minutes. I'd only been gone 20 minutes. And in 20 minutes, my whole life changed.
The Southside neighborhood where her children were shot is among the three neighborhoods identified by Columbus officials as being hit hardest by gun violence and shooting deaths. At a 2017 press conference, Mayor Andrew Ginther decried the upswing in violence.
We know that our minority communities are disproportionately affected by this spike in homicides. More than 70% of the homicide victims have been African-American men between the ages of 18 and 40.
Ginther announced he was forming a new citywide task force made up of several agencies. It's called the Violent Crime Review Group, and its goal is to lower homicide rates by tackling the underlying factors contributing to violence.
This comprehensive neighborhood safety strategy reflects our shared belief that every resident and every family deserves to be safe in every neighborhood. And if we are to achieve this goal, we must begin new initiatives to address crime differently.
Dr. Myshika Roberts is the director of the city's public health department, and she runs the review group. Roberts says their approach is to treat gun violence like an infectious disease.
We try to figure out what the culprit is, what the trend is, and where an intervention can be.
Immediately after a shooting, members spring into action. Recreation and Parks finds out if the crime was gang-related and tries to prevent retaliation. To deter crime, the Department of Neighborhoods assesses if streetlights need repair.
We went all the way down and canvassed on both sides of the street just to make sure that the residents knew that we were here for them.
Marianne Stuckey shows me around a West Side neighborhood, which has high rates of gun violence. She's a member of the CARE Coalition, an offshoot of the Public Health Department that works specifically on outreach. After a shooting, her group knocks on doors to see if residents need to be connected to therapy or other resources. She remembers knocking on the door of a mother who said she dove on top of her children to protect them from stray bullets.
And so she was telling us that she was scared to even answer the door. So for us to come and just check on her, she felt really grateful for that. And she was ready to see what she can do to try to work through some of those trauma symptoms because she was scared of just being in her own apartment.
This year, CARE has knocked on more than 800 doors. They've identified more than 40 vacant homes to be boarded up. After the deaths of her two children, Crystal Logan joined the CARE team and now helps with community outreach after shootings.
When everything first happened, I remember asking God, why? Why me? Why my family? And he gave me back a very quick answer and said their deaths were necessary in order to bring about change.
As we speak, a man walks up to her. They talk for a moment, then he hugs her.
He recognized me from the office and just wanted to give me a hug and encourage me and to say that I'm motivating him, being strong after the loss of my two children.
Despite all the violence, she says there's still a lot of love left in these neighborhoods. Since the city's efforts launched in 2017, homicides in Columbus are down about 30%. For Here and Now, I'm Paige Flager.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world. And when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations. Thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
In Iceland, we have our own Santa Clauses. They are 13 brothers. They live in the mountains with their parents.
On our recent trip to Iceland, we heard a story we thought appropriate for Christmas Eve. It's not, though, about Iceland's sibling Santa Clauses, who have names like Door Slammer and Candle Stealer, and who children try to placate by being good, so when they put their little shoes on the windowsill at night, they will get a gift and not a rotten potato. Or worse, a visit from the Santa's mom.
She would come to town and catch the naughty children. And when I was a kid, I knew that she would cook the kids for dinner.
That's
that's terrible. I was afraid of her. She died of starvation.
There you get a sense of Icelanders' dry humor and storytelling skills, maybe born of long, dark winter days with only a few hours of light, and their otherworldly landscape that inspired Tolkien and Jules Verne. It's easy to believe volcanic mountains might be home to ogre Santas or elves.
My name is Sigurbjörg Karlsdóttir, but everybody calls me Sippa. And we are now in the capital of the elves in Hafnarfjörður.
There, that's good.
Yes, elves. And Sippa is about to give us an elf tour. 54% of Icelanders believe in the so-called hidden people. And the rest?
They don't disbelieve in them.
Yeah. See, the thing is, they don't want to rule it out. I don't see them myself.
I was going to ask, have you seen one?
No, well, I've only seen one in my dream. And it's not important whether you believe the elves are here or not. This is part of the culture. It's just part of life.
Well, we have a map that we are given on the tour. Beautiful little drawings. We'll have pictures at herenow.org. But things like elves like to live near the swimming pools of beautiful homes.
Well, this is a map made by the seer, Erla Stefansdóttir.
Seer in that literally she could see the elves.
Yes, she could see those creatures.
And people, you know, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but people didn't make fun of her. They didn't.
I'm sure some people did. But also she was respected.
So we begin our walk.
We just have to cross the street here.
Hearing how when God paid a visit to Adam and Eve, Eve was so ashamed her children were dirty, she hid them in the mountains. God declared that what was hidden from him would remain hidden forever, the hidden people. Sippa's own uncle claimed an elf helped him tend the sheep at night when he was a child, gave him a rock as a gift. Then when the uncle grew old, he could no longer see the elf.
As an old man, he was looking for the rock he had given him, and he found it in his drawer. He held it in his hand, and the rock vanished. And he told us he was sure his friend was still around and had taken it. Okay, here we need to watch our step. We come this way.
This is enchanted.
We are in a beautiful park, a volcanic field of black rock and dark green moss, birch trees and red winter berries. This place is supposedly silly with elves. We scramble up on a huge boulder called Elf Rock.
Okay.
You can come up here and see if anybody's home.
Okay.
Watch your step.
People come here to meditate and feel the hidden people energy and maybe ask their forgiveness.
if we cross them, if we try to break down their house or do something they don't like, they will put a spell on us.
Well, we heard of, you know, people trying to build roads.
Yes.
And people protested the building of the roads because it might go through a boulder.
Yeah. A man that studied at the university, he collected stories from older road workers.
Saying what?
Saying when the guys were making a new road, they would come to a rock or a hill and everything would go wrong. And in the end, they would go around the rock and then everything was okay. Around 1970, they were making a big road out of Reykjavik. And in the middle of the road, there was a big rock and things started to happen. Guys were falling down, hurting themselves. And people were saying, this is an elf rock and this is why everything is going wrong here. In the end, it was decided to have somebody come who negotiated with the elves. They moved out and the rock was moved to the side of the road and it's still there.
They do seem to be almost a conscience of the country when it comes to caring for the countryside.
Well, when I was growing up, my father had many stories from his family about the elves. And he taught us, his children, respect for nature. I think in many ways, it is. It's a great, great word to use. Conscious of the country. I like that.
All right, here we go. We're looking for elf living spaces.
Oh, yes. We will.
I think most Icelanders you meet, if you would ask them if they believe in elves, trolls, you know, hidden people, they would say, well, I can't outrule that they exist. And that is my answer.
That's Iceland's young progressive minister of the environment, Gudmundur Gudbrandsson, the son of farmers who went to school in the U.S.,
I was telling my classmates, especially from the U.S., the elves and trolls in Iceland and the hidden people, I could read from their eyes and their expressions, he's crazy, he's so crazy. Mm-hmm. Until I met a student from Hawaii, and she was like, yeah, of course. Yeah, no, I understand, we have those two volcanic islands. Is there a connection there? I ask myself. So what is it in our environment that makes us be more likely to believe in hidden people?
To him, it's the rock formations. As a child, he was told they were trolls, frozen into contorted positions when the sun hit them.
And you know, we can point at something in the landscape that is sort of a proof.
Personally, I don't think that has nothing to do with it. It only has to do with when this is accepted, which is still in Iceland, then everybody dare to talk about their experiences. That's why so many believe in elves.
That's Professor Magnus Skarphéðinsson at the Elf School in Reykjavik. Actually, Magnus's delightfully cluttered apartment, books and elf figurines piled high. We've pulled up chairs in the small parlor with five students from around the world as Magnus, who looks a little Santa-like himself, tells stories and takes questions.
We have hundreds, we have thousands of such stories. We collect them. We store them in special files.
The climate change and the elves connected, or at least the disappearing of the elves.
That's right. I met more than 900 Icelanders and 500 foreigners from 40 countries that have seen elves. 65 or 70 have met them regularly. The hidden people and the elves is always asking them, humans, why do you pollute so much? You have to stop this global warming and stop this pollution. You will kill yourself and you will also kill us. You have to change.
When did this start, and why do you think here?
There's only one reason why we have the elves. That is because the Enlightenment that started in Europe in 1600, which was a very good movement, very, changed the world more than word can express, but it has price. It killed faith in the world, cleaned out all myth and mythology. And the Enlightenment never came to Iceland. That's why we have still have the elves.
Yeah, I think you have to ask your First Nations about that.
That's Tina Bucher from Germany. You think that in the American Indian, the indigenous people probably had some of the same beliefs that were wiped out?
Yeah, I think spirits like everywhere in the world.
Can I just ask, does everybody in this room who's at the class here now, are you here now because you also have a belief in elves or you wanted to find out more?
So I believe and I know that they exist.
I just wanted to know if I could find them myself one day. Yeah, I think there is a connection with nature.
I'm very interested in myths and legends in Ireland.
That's Patricia McAteer, before that her husband John from Ireland. We also heard from a woman named Sunshine from New York. But John and Patricia from Ireland actually claim sightings.
Mm-hmm. Mine was in Donegal, in a very sacred site called Ungreenon. And the elf was halfway up the mountain, almost like the age of about a 14-year-old, but much older in features. Did have pointy ears and was in the expected green-brown outfit. Was very wary and cautious of me.
Are you sure that...
Absolutely positive. Yeah. It was an elf. Absolutely and utterly positive. And he just went like that.
Professor, what do you say to people who are going to hear this and just think you are all out of your minds?
Yes. But the most reason why 54% believe in elves is all Icelanders know some witnesses. Their grandma or grandpa or parent, when they tell you their elf experience, they are very sincere. This happened to me. And that's why people dare to talk about that experience. This is accepted part of the culture.
Elves are wonderful creatures, and we take them seriously.
That is Siggy Hilmerson. Remember, he showed us how to bake bread in hot springs. We want to leave you with his thoughts on elves.
If we come across a huge rock, we sometimes get a special person that speaks to the elves and get, you know, permission.
It's, you're smiling, but you're serious.
Yeah, it's a smiling, serious thing. There is a song that you should listen to. The lyrics go like, are elves perhaps men? Eru álvar kannski menn? Eru álvar kannski menn? We smile, but we take it seriously.
This year marks the first time in U.S. history that we've started a decade without a recession and ended it without a recession. And while that's good news, not all Americans are feeling that expansion. In fact, according to a new stateline analysis of U.S. Census data from 2016 to 2018, the poverty rate has actually increased in a third of all U.S. counties. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Robin.
And by the way, happy holidays.
Thank you, and to you.
But yes, but apparently not to everyone. So,
no.
You know, we've been hearing for so long, we know the economy is strong, the bull market, unemployment, the national poverty rate fell from 13% in 2016 to 12% in 2018. So that's going down. These are households of four living on less than $26,000 a year. But at the county level, tell us about this variation.
Yeah, and I would say that 10 years ago, you could take top line numbers like GDP and unemployment and things like that and have it have some sense that it was reflecting the economy. What we're learning here is that in our current economy, that's not the case. So we've got good GDP. We've got stock markets at great records. We've got unemployment below 3%. We've got 500,000 people living on the street. We have 40 million Americans who are food insecure, more than the entire population of Canada. And we've got poverty increasing in a number of counties. 30% of counties increased their poverty rates between 2016 and 2018. So while the national poverty level is coming down, certain parts of the country are getting poorer.
Right. Well, Bullock County, Alabama, one of the biggest increases, poverty rate jumped 10% over the last 2 years to an astonishing 42.5%. And this is a county with jobs at the airport, the prison, the poultry plant. Is it just no one's willing to work those jobs?
Well, so what you'll find is places where the poverty rate has increased are places where there's a very low minimum wage, right? The federal minimum wage remains $7.25. There are lots of states and municipalities that have higher minimum wages, including some that have $15 an hour. But through the Southeast, where you've seen most of the increase in poverty, that's where you're seeing it. In places where people are discouraged, they remain in poverty. Even if they're getting a job, it doesn't meet their expenses. and people are aging out. So it's got to do with the makeup of the population. We still have a shortage of workers for jobs, but the jobs aren't in the places where people right. are. And this whole concept of economic mobility, which we're really built on as a country, isn't working for people because we don't really have methodologies for getting people out of coal mining towns or right. old manufacturing towns into high-wage jobs.
And many of these people aren't showing up on the unemployment rates because they're not looking. And here's
Correct.
Just in the minute we have, people might be saying, oh, that's just public radio throwing a bucket of water on President Trump's economy. No. The Brookings Institute has written about how a decade ago, voters in Republican and Democratic districts earned the same amount.
Yeah.
Today, the median in a Democratic district is $61,000. In Republican districts, it's
$53,000. Yes. So there's automation. There's AI. Working class men have really suffered. And before anybody thinks you're throwing hot water on it, the economy's strong. This is a Western world, developed world problem. It's not a uniquely American right. problem. It's just a little bit exaggerated in the United States.
Well, we have to say it's in pockets of the country that have been promised that certain jobs would come back, and
Correct.
They haven't.
And they're not coming back.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
A little while ago, we covered fast fashion and its impact on the environment, and that got us thinking, have you ever considered where your clothes come from? Our producer, Marcel Hutchins, took to the streets of Boston to ask folks this very question.
What about you, sir? I mean, I would like to know what you're wearing.
I'm wearing a nice warm vest that I got as a gift from my mother-in-law. This is a sweatshirt from when I used to work on movies. I've had this for over 20 years. I've got some running shoes on that I bought from my town in Bel Air that's run. It's locally owned. And then if I have anything on that's probably somewhat irresponsible, it's a fairly new pair of Levi's.
Can you explain to me what you have on right now?
I have on a Ralph Lauren coat. A sweater was given to me by someone. And the pants I got from Goodwill.
And when you think about the clothes that you buy, do you think about who made them, where it came from, or are you just looking for the style and, like, what's trendy?
No, I'm on a budget. I have college kids. I shop to supply my pockets.
Can you tell me where you bought your clothes?
Yes. So my shirt and pants are from Rennie Melville. I'm wearing Doc Martens and a Columbia jacket.
And do you know which country your clothes is made?
I do not specifically know, but what I would think is possibly from South America or somewhere, I don't know, maybe in like Africa or something? I'm not sure.
That was Tally Duckworth, Lorna Boston, and Bob Schick. For more on where our clothes come from, we have with us Maxine Badette. She is the founder and director of the New Standard Institute, an online data platform for designers and brands that want to become more sustainable. Maxine joins us from London. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Maxine, you know the global fashion industry has a surprisingly complicated supply chain. It's not really easy to just say, okay, I'm going to start a clothing company, hire some folks to make some clothes and sell them, at least not on a global scale. But a lot of the general public, we don't really know this. Can you explain how you work with designers and brands on how to become more sustainable?
Yeah, I think for listeners, it kind of seems like magic. We go to a store and the clothing is there, or it's online, and with the click of a button, it's, you know, at our doorstep. But what might not be taken into account and what might people not be aware of is that that garment might have traveled around the world in its creation. The cotton, you know, might have started in India. The material might then have been produced in China. It might have been cut and sewn in Bangladesh and then sold to us in the United States. So it's really a global journey that clothing can take before it's even in our hands. And what has happened in the past two decades or so is that the clothing companies have really lost track themselves of where their own clothing has been made.
Wow.
And so it's really, it's quite astonishing. And so really the way that we can work with brands is by getting them reconnected with their supply chain, you know, through each of those steps that I mentioned, working on how to make it more sustainable, both from an environmental perspective and also from a labor side as well.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the labor side. Fashion boutiques like Fashion Nova have recently come under fire for producing clothes made by underpaid workers here in California. It's actually part of the reason why we wanted to do this story. How common is this practice?
Very common, unfortunately. The U.S. Department of Labor, which does research on kind of the global hotspots for exploited labor and modern-day slavery and child labor, really zero in on the fashion industry because it's almost par for the course in terms of the clothing that we're wearing today is very often from that type of exploited labor. It's kind of become almost integral to how our clothing is produced.
What are some of the regulatory standards for making certain that these clothes, especially sold here in the United States, are made in factories that are up to code and where people are really treated humanely?
Yeah, so I think the thing to keep in mind, you know, certainly with Fashion Nova, which was found to be made in the United States with exploited labor, the good part of that story was that it was uncovered by investigators in the Department of Labor. So in that respect, it's showing a system that is functioning. That is what makes the United States and Europe different than where a lot of our other clothing is produced in places like China, in Bangladesh, in Vietnam.
Are there pressures from the United States to these other countries to have tougher regulations if these clothes are being sold here?
Not yet. And I think bringing to light that this is how our clothing is produced is the first step to get those type of pressures and regulations because it's not there at the moment.
You know, I remember back in the early 2000s, there was a big campaign to get folks to look at their labels, the Made In labels. At the time, the push was to get folks to buy Made In America clothing. But taking this idea a step further, what does actually Made In so-and-so tell us? What do we do with this information if we're looking at our labels and we say, okay, this was made in Bangladesh, this was made in India or China? How do we make sure from that point that we push these brands to source responsibly?
I think at where we are at this stage, if you look back at the food industry, maybe 20 years ago is where clothing is today, where we have now brought to light that these issues exist. And now is the time, especially with social media, that we can begin to ask brands seriously, who is making my clothes? How much are they being paid? How are workers being treated? And it's only by asking that question will brands stand up and begin to take responsibility for the conditions in the factories that are producing their clothing.
You're actually a co-chair of the Fashion Revolution Day. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so Fashion Revolution Day is a wonderful campaign that began in honor of the over 1,000 lives that were lost in a building collapse in Bangladesh. What the Fashion Revolution Day is bringing to light these issues, having people take a look at their tags and asking the brands, who made my clothes, as really the start of the effort for brands to, again, take responsibility. I can say, you know, what is happening right now, and this was the case with Fashion Nova as well, is that brands are kind of hiding behind what is called these industry agreements. It's a vendor code of conduct, and what they are saying to the factories, the Fashion Nova factories, is if we work with you, we expect that your workers are being paid fairly, and that your factory is safe. But on the other hand, they're only paying the factories very little. And so the factories are really stuck between a rock and a hard place where they get the deal and not pay their workers or have to say no to the deal. And so what we really at New Standard Institute are really zeroing in and focusing on is not just this vendor code of conduct, but we want to know how much are the workers who are producing the clothing that the brands are selling, how much are they making? And what are those conditions in the factory? Because only with that information do we really get transparency and an understanding of what those conditions are that we can feel good as consumers about what we're buying.
Wow. So this is now an issue in the public consciousness. You know, my daughter showed me a website the other night where their clothing companies are given scores based on how sustainable they are, how they treat their employees. And the reforms that you're talking about, as we enter 2020, what are some things that you really want to see as the next step? And what you're saying is the beginning of us really paying attention to this and pushing these companies to take action.
Yeah, I think on two things. On the labor side of things, there are two critical issues. One is, how much are the workers that are producing the clothing being made? And what are the auditors that are going into those factories? What grades are they giving those factories? Because that is also information that they are collecting, the brands are collecting. So on the labor side of things, that's what we're calling for. And then on the environmental side of things, it's understanding what is the carbon footprint and the chemical footprint inside the factories that are producing for the brands, and what are the brands' targets for reducing that.
Maxine Bidat is founder and director of the New Standard Institute, an online data platform for designers and brands looking to become more sustainable. Thank you so much, Maxine.
Thank you so much for having me.
And by the way, in a story about Fashion Nova in the New York Times, the firm's general counsel is quoted as saying, any suggestion that Fashion Nova is responsible for underpaying anyone working on our brand is categorically false.
I'm working on a novel.
It is a story of my life and my sister's.
Make it short and
sweet. Little Women, the movie based on Louisa May Alcott's beloved novel, opens in theaters tomorrow, and it's set when and where she wrote it, in mid-1800s Massachusetts. As WBUR's Andrea Shea reports, the filmmakers went to great lengths to ensure the film would look period perfect, down to the food.
There's a pivotal scene in Little Women where Meg, Amy, Beth, and Joe March come downstairs on Christmas morning to a homey breakfast of eggs, bangers, and poached pears. Instead of eating it, they pack it up for a poor woman and her hungry children. When a wealthy neighbor learns of the girls' charitable act, he surprises them with a colorful spread of decadent treats presented beautifully on silver platters.
Mr. Lawrence sent it.
Lawrence Boy's grandfather?
Yes.
Why?
He saw you giving your Christmas breakfast away, and he wanted you to enjoy the day.
From the get-go, the number one priority for this Christmas feast from the Lawrence house was there had to be ice cream, and it had to be pink.
Like it is in Alcott's book, as the film's food stylist, Christine Tobin managed a mountain of pink peppermint on set, replacing scoops as they melted in a punch bowl. She researched, designed, sourced, and prepared all of the food in Little Women to be period appropriate, much of it here in her Boston kitchen. Tobin shows me how she made molasses cookies for the movie the way 19th century families like the Marches did, with ginger, cloves, and cinnamon.
Everything that they would have had in their kitchen.
Tobin perfected popovers, hand pies, shortcakes, biscuits, and found scones and brambles at local bakeries. She says the Marches, who are based on Alcott's real family, had fruit trees and a garden, so she pickled plums, veggies, and limes months before filming began.
You had to really then research and make sure those foods that were on the table would have been brought in or taken out of jars because they were preserved.
We all wanted the movie to feel very real.
That's Little Women film producer Amy Pascal. She also helmed the 1994 adaptation. For her, laboring over historically accurate touches makes the world we see on screen believable.
Movies work on such an emotional level when they work. And all of these things are things that you experience cognitively while you're watching a film. So when someone doesn't think about all of these details, movies just don't feel as rich.
Pascal says the movie also needed to be geographically correct.
It was critical that it be filmed in Massachusetts. That's a gigantic part of what the movie is about, and we needed to capture it because the movie is also about Louisa May Alcott, and Louisa May Alcott's life is here.
Film crews transformed more than a dozen historic properties in places like Ipswich, Boston, and most importantly, Concord, where Alcott lived. She wrote Little Women in 1868 at her home known as Orchard House. Today, it survives as a museum. The filmmakers couldn't shoot there, so they painstakingly constructed a replica of the exterior a few miles away to stand in as the March family's home. Adam Rothman crunches through a snowy field where the temporary exterior used to be.
Their house was right over here, just past this tree here. So they had a view of the Lawrence house.
He oversaw continuity with the film's art department as on-set dresser and says the interiors were reproduced in a Franklin warehouse about an hour away. Rothman recalls how director Greta Gerwig wanted every set and prop to look lived in and of its time. The lace curtains, the bedding, the furniture. The team even used real candles and vintage oil lamps for their natural glow and the sooty smudges they left on the wallpaper.
Claire, our decorator, and our art directors, and Jess, the designer, all spent a lot of time at the actual Orchard House speaking with all of the experts on Louisa May Alcott and her family, getting as much information, doing as much research as possible to get the house right.
This house holds such emotion for people. The book holds such emotion for people. Now this movie will hold so much emotion for people. It connects with their daily lives.
Jan Turnquist, Orchard House director of 20 years, says this in a room filled with Alcott's actual furniture, artwork, and piano. She fielded a slew of questions from the people who made Little Women and thinks their hard work will pay off. Turnquist talks to a lot of discerning Alcott fans and says one person mused that visiting Orchard House could almost be like going to Hogwarts after seeing Harry Potter.
But Hogwarts is imaginary. You can create it, but there is no real Hogwarts. This is the real thing. So to have that authentically recreated means everything to many, many people.
Turnquist included. She's already seen the movie a few times and is preparing her staff for a flood of Little Women tourists after the film opens tomorrow. For Here and Now, I'm Andrea Shea.
Can't wait to see it. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. From the gang here, Kwanzaa starts this week, Christmas tomorrow, Hanukkah ongoing.
Happy holidays to everyone. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.